This is Car Expert.
Navigating a tight and twisty, which is hatted circuit is really that car's happy place.
Inside the C5X, they've got what they call advanced comfort seats, which have a padding that they say is like a mattress topper.
You can brake later than you could in a 911 turbo, which for that size and heft of a vehicle is extraordinary in itself.
Hello, my name's Mandy Turner. A big hello this week to James Wong.
Hola, Mandy.
And William Stopford. Hello.
A big hello to you too, Mandy.
You're still in Melbourne, I see, because we can see each other and I can see the Melbourne office background.
Stalker.
Yeah. I'm actually keen, because you're from Brisbane. Mm-hmm. I'm keen to hear what you think of what it's like driving on Melbourne roads.
Yeah, look, I mean, okay, so the only time I've ever driven a car in Victoria is driving out of Melbourne. Like, I've spent very little time actually driving within the metro area. It's always been to get to the Great Ocean Road. So I was making myself a little bit anxious. I don't know why, because I think it's just because you guys have trams and Brisbane ripped them all up in the 60s. So I keep thinking like, oh, wow, man, are there like different rules? Like, do you have different lane markings? What are these tram turns? What do you call hook turns?
The hook turn. Have you done that yet?
I haven't actually done it.
It's terrifying.
I thought there'd be a hook turn on like every corner, but there's not. And I've been staying over in the, I don't know if you'd call it the inner east. I'm still, my Melbourne geography is terrible. But I thought, oh, I'm going to be really anxious. And then the first car I get given to drive down here is a BMW X5. So I'm like, here I'm in this giant SUV.
Tiny car.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Tiny, zipping around. But I think within like a couple of days, I just felt quite comfortable driving here in Melbourne. I mean, the traffic is atrocious, but Brisbane traffic is certainly getting worse.
How do you compare the drivers?
Oh, look. People, I didn't think Melbourne drivers seem to be any worse. They might be a little bit more clued in than some Brisbane drivers. Oh, God, I shouldn't say anything controversial like that. But I haven't been driving here long enough. So, I mean, I think ultimately there are just stupid drivers in every city. Yes. I've never really been in a city where I've noticed like a preponderance of exceptionally stupid people on the roads. So, but yeah, Melbourne is not as scary to drive in as I would have thought.
JWO, you've spent some time recently at the Car Expert Experience Centre, or the CEEC as we call it. Pretty much spoken to everyone else in the team about how it's going there. How are you finding it?
Well, I just came back from there a couple of days ago, so I spent the most recent weekend up there, and it's really my first real involvement with it because I wasn't too across the setup and everything because my job is more site-based and sub-editing everyone's reviews and stuff, so I wasn't really able to get away and do much of the setup for it. But it was really interesting because we have such a variety of cars there. I haven't spent much time in Sydney period, but to be up in like Warringah, which is sort of a different, the Northern Beaches is another sort of like its own little world up there. People don't tend to move around in Sydney the same way that we do in Melbourne. So there's a lot of locals and then maybe some people from further up north that come down. And the day that I got up there, which was a Friday, I think our news segment had just aired. So a lot of people came in being like, oh, what's this? We saw you on the news. We're just seeing what it's about. And then, you know, we're more talking about what exactly we're offering there. And then on the weekend, people came in with a bit more purpose. So I was actually talking to a lot of people on the floor that were in the market to buy a car. They had been looking at a lot of the stuff that was in our space, showroom, center, whatever you want to call it. And there's actually a few different people that I was helping to organize test drives of multiple cars in the center. So one particular story that was actually a really fun tale was this middle-aged lady who was very enthusiastic about looking at all the compact SUVs. And so she had quite an active lifestyle. She goes camping a lot. She has camera gear because she has a hobby for photography. And then she was there with a friend of hers who was just chauffeuring her around because one of her car, I think her car had just died on her or something. So she was she was a bit desperate for a new car. And so she looked at, we have of the compact SUVs, we have the Kia Seltos, the Hyundai Kona, the Renault Captur, and the Mitsubishi Eclipse Cross, to name several. We have a couple of other ones in there, but these are the ones that she was looking at. And so I was basically saying to her, maybe you should just try all of them out for test drives because, you know, you can play around with the seats and see if, you know, you got good visibility and stuff, but it probably won't be the same when you're out on the road. So why don't you just try a few of them or try all of them if you want. And she was like, do you know what? I'm going to do that. So I booked her into 4 test drives in one day. And this woman was in and out of the center for about 2 hours taking out. She went out in the Captor, then she went out in the Seltos, then she went out in the Kona, then she went out in the Eclipse. I didn't, unfortunately, was busy talking to other people when she finished up. So I didn't get to find out which one was her favorite and whether she was going to buy one. I did hear from one of the people on the floor that she didn't like the Captor because I think she wasn't used to driving a dual clutch transmission and she wasn't super comfortable with how it drove. But
I like that she recognized that though. She actually felt that.
Yeah. So yeah. You know, I tried to give as realistic advice to people as I could because obviously I'm used to driving dual clutch cars because I drive a Golf GTI myself. And so we have I actually had mixed reviews from colleagues about the Nissan Juke because that has quite a polarizing transmission. But then I drove it around in Sydney for a night and I actually didn't find it too bad. But I think that's because I'm so used to being very modular with the throttle inputs and things like that, that I sort of just understand how it works and I can sort of feel when it's going to be jerky or not. So I was trying to minimize that as much as possible. Whereas I know a lot of people, like even my mum, for example, or my sister, when she first drove my car, when I was taking her out for L plate tests or whatever, which I know very brave of me. It's a bit of a learning curve. So I can understand why for a lot of people, it can actually be quite polarizing. So without telling my life story while I was there, it was a really great experience for me to actually be in a place like that and being able to give people advice, even about cars that aren't even on the floor. A lot of people just had questions about cars we didn't have and just to have conversations with real car buyers and understanding what they're looking for, what kind of cars they cross shop, because some of them had very odd sets of cars that they were looking at. I had one girl who was probably younger than me who was buying her first car and she wanted an SUV that was diesel, and because she was about to move away for uni and she was going to be 9 hours from Sydney and she needed to do a lot of driving. So there's some really odd things in there. She was looking at an ASX, an X-Trail, and anything else that offered a diesel engine. So you get some really interesting shoppers in there. So for me, it was a great experience. And the feedback that I got from a lot of the people in there was quite positive, which is great to hear. So hopefully it's something that people really connect with and we can expand further. And, hopefully people in Melbourne want something similar so we can give a similar sort of experience to them.
Yeah, well, it sounds like it's going great guns, so no doubt it will feed its way into Victoria and Queensland at some point.
Hopefully. I've got a Westfield up for my house. It would be very convenient.
Yes. Let's talk about this week's biggest car news. I don't know if this is going to be huge news, J-Wo. The 2021 Nissan GT-R Nismo has been revealed, but not much has really changed.
Yes, every year we always get a press release being like, new GT-R or new GT-R Nismo. We're like, oh, what's changed? And then you see the photos and you're like, ah. Don't hate me, Nissan. But so the 2021 model has had very, very minor revisions. So they've done a few like aesthetic details. You got red pinstriping on the wheels and things like that. I don't even know if that's standard on the current one. But the headlining changes for this year are a new carbon, like exposed carbon fiber bonnet, as well as
which looks incredible.
It looks great. It's very it's all that Need for Speed stuff. You know how everyone used to get a contrasting bonnet back in the day when you had like Need for Speed Underground? This gives off a lot of that vibe. And I think in the Fast and Furious generation, it was a very popular thing too to have a different coloured bonnet that was exposed carbon fibre because, rich. there's that. Other than that, there's really the only other thing is that it's got a new paint job. So you can get this stealth grey, which they say is inspired by track tarmac, but track tarmac is a deep grey. I can't imagine. Yeah, I don't know what tarmac they're racing on because it's not black. So,
but apparently this in Japan.
Yeah, so this new bonnet apparently saves 100 grams, and I assume that's how much weight paint puts on it. So you're 100 grams lighter at the front. So I don't know whether that helps turn in or adds extra grip. I don't know. But, it looks great, and I love that Nissan continues to somewhat refine the GTR well into its life. It's still a very cool car, and I guess if you saw one spec like it is in the press images, you'd probably turn your head and go like, oh, that looks cool. And it's still stupidly fast. The engine's still the same. So it runs the same 3.8-litre twin turbo V6, which still develops 441 kilowatts of power and 652 newton meters of torque. So it's nothing to sneeze at, all jokes aside. It's still stupidly fast, both on the road and on the track. It looks like a GT3 GT3 racer for the road. So if you're sick of seeing all the Porsche 911 GT3s like we do in Melbourne, all over the place in the city and in and around Richmond where the dealership is, I'm sure this one will stick out a little bit more. And obviously there's that heritage of buying a Godzilla. Which I know that somebody like our friend Melissa Ong would appreciate very much. So I guess worthwhile changes for people who are fans of the car, but in an age where we're seeing, like, you know, crazy plug-in hybrids and spaceship-like designs and everything, we're probably just hanging out for the next generation of GTR, which if anything...
How old is this, Jen?
It came out in like 2007. Like it's a good 14 years old.
It's aging pretty well.
Yeah, it still looks amazing. Good. Yeah, it looked amazing when it came out. I think it's more the tech inside that's really aged, because the actual look of it looks awesome. But yeah, the car's almost as old as me. So
that's scary. Yeah.
I don't know who's aged
better.
It
would take 10 years.
Yeah. But, yeah. So that's really the crux of it for 2021.
Yeah. Okay. Nice.
Oh, it's got the new Nissan badge. It's got the new Nissan badge as well.
Oh, that's pretty important. And it does. Actually, I don't mind the new Nissan badge.
It looks good. It looks good.
Yeah. I love how manufacturers are doing these new flat designs, because they age much better. It's like when Apple moved from like the depth squircles to like the flat design. It ages much better. Yeah.
Will, do you love the badges? What do you love about the Nissan badge?
What do I love about the Nissan badge?
Yeah.
I just think the new one just looks a lot cleaner. And the old one had been around for so long. And it's an example of a nice badge change, unlike one recently, Peugeot, which I'm not.
Oh, not a fan.
It would be a perfectly fine logo if the old logo didn't look that much better. One of my favorite logos out there. So, but yeah, James is absolutely right. These flatter logos, I think, will definitely age better.
Hmm. Yeah. Okay, we'll move on now. Will, GWM, this is going to be really interesting. It's planning a rival to the Ram 1500.
It is really, really, really interesting, because right now it's the American brands just basically dominate this space. Nissan and Toyota have rivals for the likes of the Ram 1500, Chevy Silverado and Ford F-Series, but they don't bring them here. But we understand that GWM is actually evaluating this pickup for Australia. So it's going to be one of many, many, many debuts at this year's Shanghai Motor Show. There have been some shadowy teasers that have been released of it, and it's also been spied testing. The reason why it's exciting is because this is a considerably larger ute or pickup truck than the likes of GWM's current ute, which is already on the big side for its class. It's going to be considerably larger than the likes of the Hilux and the Ranger as well. And what we've seen with the GWM ute is, if you compare spec for spec, yeah, sure, the ute is a little bit less powerful than a Hilux, a top spec Hilux or top spec Ranger. But in terms of equipment, the GWM will often undercut those rivals by upwards of $20,000. So it stands to reason that if GWM introduces a bigger pickup truck, that could seriously undercut your locally converted Ram 1500, your locally converted Chevy Silverado. Now, the Ram 1500, the outgoing shape, starts at around $80,000 or so before on-road costs. The Chevy Silverado is over $100,000. If GWM could get this truck here for $60,000-$70,000, that's the price kind of strata that your top spec Hiluxes and Rangers are getting into. And reports are indicating that it will use, so GWM has actually, and for those who find that acronym or unfamiliar, GWM is what Great Wall is rebranded as. So it is a brand of Great Wall Motors along with Havel. They've previously announced that they were developing a turbocharged 3-litre six-cylinder engine with 260 kilowatts of power and 500 newton meters of torque. So reports are indicating that that's what this truck will use.
It's quite capable of being a tow vehicle, I'm assuming.
Yeah, it is a petrol engine, but that's not necessarily an impediment, because as we've seen, there's plenty of Ram 1500s out on the road, and almost all of them are petrol. The Chevy Silverado is only offered here with a petrol V8. This is expected to have four-wheel drive with a center diff lock, a 9-speed automatic transmission, and it's using the body-on-frame tank architecture.
Great name.
It's better than Lemon architecture, which is one of the other platforms.
Yeah, I don't think the literal translations from Chinese always go very well.
No, I don't know. It stands for something. I don't know if tank stands for anything, but it sounds cool. Now
maybe the other one's zesty. I don't know.
Lime. But the tank architecture also underpins the Wei Tank 300 that we've reported on previously, which is a slightly smaller offering. So it's a 5-seat SUV. It's a little bit smaller than a Toyota Prado. And I believe GWM GWM Havel has said that they would be interested in selling that here. So look, very, very impressive looking specs from what we've seen so far. And the teaser images make it look like a big, tough truck. And I don't know if you've seen just the GWM Ute out on the roads. It's already a pretty bloody substantial looking thing. It looks probably even bigger than its dimensions suggest. So I can only imagine what this will look like. So Shanghai Motor Show this year is certainly going to be interesting. The Chinese auto industry is back in full swing. There's going to be a lot of really interesting reveals. And this is one I'll be keeping my eye out for.
When's that motor show on?
It is this month, I believe.
Oh, is it? Really? Because we missed out on it last year, didn't we? But yeah, we would have.
Because that motor shows were cancelled last year.
Yeah. Awesome. Okay, moving on to a completely different segment, Will. The 2021 Citroen C5X has been revealed. I keep meaning to say CX5. An Australian launch has been unconfirmed, but boy, I hope we do get this thing.
Mandy, this is a very interesting looking vehicle. I love the look. Let me just say, interesting is not some kind of thinly veiled criticism of it. It looks really cool. So Citroen's actually been out of the midsize space for a few years. They discontinued the C5 both here and in Europe back in 2016, 2017. Continued on in China, but Citroen's just been out of that space. Now, what we know, what we heard is that, Ford has discontinued its Mondeo in Europe and it's likely to replace it with a kind of crossover hatch wagon thing. We've heard similar reports about Opel doing the same with its Insignia. So Citroen's kind of beaten them to the punch with this C5X. So not C5 anymore, C5X. And it's this kind of, you'll need to look at photos of it, those listeners, because it's
got about four different segments in it, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of like liftback meets wagon meets crossover. Yeah. It doesn't look like some fugly coupe SUV. I will say that. So that's good. Yay.
Thankfully.
it's about 4,800 mil long and about 1865 mil wide. So it's a little bit shorter, a little bit wider, and a little bit taller than a Toyota Camry, to give you an idea of size. So it's a big thing. Now, they haven't released full specifications, but they have announced, when I say they, I mean Citroen. Citroen has announced that there's going to be a plug-in hybrid version, which will have a total output of 167 kilowatts, and it promises an electric range of more than 50 kilometers under the stricter WLTP standard. So that's really similar to the Peugeot 508 hybrid, which is also part of the Stellantis stable. Based on that, it seems like the plug-in hybrid would likely be front-wheel drive, likely have an 8-speed automatic, but as I said, Citroen hasn't confirmed those details yet. Now, it's got this kind of funky alternative design, which I always love when Citroen does this because they've got such a bloody rich heritage of making cars slightly outside the norm. Now, I'm not saying this is DS levels of revolutionary because, I mean, that thing still looks new today, but it is. It's certainly very, very distinctive. Now, Citroen has moved on from hydropneumatic suspension. Oh, that makes me sad. They have something called advanced comfort suspension, which I believe is also in the C5 Aircross crossover SUV. It doesn't have the hydropneumatic spheres anymore. It's got progressive hydraulic cushions, they call them. It promises a magic carpet ride. Let's see if that applies with the C5X. But Citroen, I really love this about Citroen. They're very
actively pushing this idea of comfort first. So inside the C5X, just like the C5 Aircross, they've got what they call advanced comfort seats, which have a padding that they say is like a mattress topper. And there's like a layer of thick foam in them as well. So there's a real emphasis on comfort with this. That and the fact that it looks really cool. I hope they bring it here. They haven't confirmed it for here. They've confirmed the kind of vaguely similarly styled C4. For an Australian launch, last I checked, I wrote that article. I should remember that, which is a very similar kind of lifted hatchback kind of genre-busting thing going on there. That'll have an electric version as well. Now, we know that Citroën is not a high-volume brand here, but doggone it, they keep trying every year. They're one of the longest-running importers of vehicles in Australia, and no matter how much people just ignore them, they keep offering really funky vehicles here. We've got a seat.
That's what I'm worried about. Like, if Citroën does bring it here, are people going to buy it?
No, well,
it's the sad reality, isn't it?
I mean, look at Peugeot. Peugeot sells considerably better. They've got an amazing array of cars, but they're just not on people's radars. And it's very interesting that upstart brands can come in the meantime and get the level of market share and sales volumes that the French brands just could never dream of. So it is really sad. I mean, I wish Australians paid more attention to French vehicles, but, you know, sometimes that's partly on the French brands for not pricing or specifying cars correctly. So let's see, you know, if the C5X comes here, if it's priced competitively, time will tell. But at this stage, it hasn't been confirmed for Australia.
And the last of the news stories for this week, we bring in Mike Costello. Hello, Moco.
Hello, Mandy. Hello, guys.
Now, this week, the pricing and specs have been released for the Toyota Mirai. You have driven this and the review will be coming up very soon, but we thought we might get you on just to talk about the details of it first.
Yeah, so the Mirai is the second hydrogen fuel cell vehicle to actually get ADR approval and enter fleet sales in Australia in the past few weeks. The Hyundai Nexo narrowly beat it to the punch. Just like Hyundai, Toyota has imported 20 of these that it's going to farm out to various fleet partners in local government and in big corporate at a price of $1,750 a month over 3-year and $60,000 fleet contract, which equates to $63,000 over the course of the lease. And that includes hydrogen, which is provided by its own solar-powered refueler in inner Western Melbourne. And then there's a small charge on top of that for servicing. Now, this is a really interesting vehicle. Obviously, that's quite a prohibitively expensive type of technology, sort of reminiscent of the first iterations of the plasma screen TVs that cost $20,000. but hydrogen fuel cell is one of those technologies that is widely seen also as a massive part of the decarbonisation of industry. So, in short, hydrogen is pressurised and stored in gas form, put into a vehicle's tanks where it is mixed in a fuel cell with atmospheric oxygen, and the electricity created by that chemical reaction drives the wheels, and the only emissions that come out are water from the tailpipe, because hydrogen and oxygen makes H2O, and of course purified air that comes out cleaner than when it went in. So these are really interesting vehicles, sort of hobbled by the price, hobbled by the packaging, and hobbled by the lack of infrastructure. But the Australian government sees hydrogen as a massive part of its energy future, both for domestic and for export to markets like Korea and Japan. And Toyota and Hyundai are the world leaders in the technology. So to sort of see vehicles like this very tentatively being launched is interesting. And to kind of contextualise this car, I was speaking to Sean Hanley, who's the Vice President of Sales and Marketing for Toyota Australia, and he loves to tell the story of how he was the guy in charge of the Prius launch back in 2001. The Prius Hybrid, of course, was a ridiculously expensive vehicle 20 years ago that nobody bought, and now hybrid technology is completely mainstream. The majority of Toyota's passenger cars and family-focused SUVs are now hybrid vehicles. And he said that he can see hydrogen fuel cells take up easily eclipsing that of hybrid. In other words, becoming mainstream in maybe 10 years rather than 20 years. That goes contrary to what we've heard from the likes of Herbert Diess at Volkswagen and, of course, Elon Musk, the ever-controversial founder of Tesla, who reckon hydrogen is a cul-de-sac, technologically speaking. Toyota and Hyundai, though, are not renowned for investing billions of dollars in, you know, foolish technologies that don't work. So it's still to be determined if this is the future or not. But Putting two and two together, it seems like Toyota Australia really rates this technology. Of course, electric vehicle take-up in Australia is minuscule. There are a heck of a lot of regional buyers that don't think BEVs are right for them. The inherent upsides of hydrogen being super long driving range, rapid refill times, so for context, 3 to 5 minute refill, 600k plus range, payload minimization in the reduction of payload because you don't need heavy batteries like you would with an EV. All these things lend themselves to cars like Land Cruisers and Hiluxes. So you can really see why Toyota is looking hard at the technology. And I got the feeling at this event this week that I was kind of at the tipping point of Toyota really getting behind the technology alongside BEV. One thing that is sure is the next decade is going to be extremely interesting as we work through what the energy mix is going to be moving forward.
In photos, it looks like a much larger car. Yeah.
Well, the old Mirai was pretty fugly, and the new one is pretty sexy. And that's because it's a halo. It's sort of a marketing tool. I mean, I don't think anybody seriously expects that a sexy four-door, you know, grand coupe-style vehicle is the ultimate use or application of hydrogen fuel cell technology. But it is roughly Camry-sized at just under 5 metres long. It's rear-wheel drive. It is a sleek five-door sedan. I got to say the packaging is inherently flawed because of the fact that it's got three big hydrogen tanks in the floor pan. The back seats are pretty tight. There are technically five seats in the car, but really there's four, and even the back row adults my size struggle. The boot's also tiny, so there's lots of packaging issues to be overcome, but it's definitely an eye-turning thing. I spent some time driving it around my local area in the inner west of Melbourne, and let's just say that a lot of people were very curious about what the hell I was driving, this bright sort of royal blue, sleek, utterly silent Toyota sedan with water dripping out of it as it drove along is a pretty fascinating thing to behold. So, yeah, it's the kind of car that I think it's easy to look at it and say, you know what, right now, you know, hybrid Camry taxis are everywhere. Camry hybrid Ubers are everywhere. There's a part of me that looked at this car and just thought, man, I can see easily in 2030 a sort of hub, you know, with a hydrogen refueler, a back-to-base kind of operation, and for those Mirais to be the Camry hybrid of the future. I think there's a lot of scope for that alongside more conventional battery electric cars.
Yeah, the future is not far away at all in terms of that technology. Marco, while we are on the subject of Toyota, you've driven something that's just a bit louder and a bit smaller than the Mirai. Yeah. The GR Yaris Rally, what was that like to drive?
Yeah, so Rally, spelt with an E on the end in the European way. This is a special edition, not a limited edition, but a special edition of the incredibly well-received GR Yaris Mega Hatch. Just to go back before we go forward, you might recall that Toyota launched the Yaris GR, or GR Yaris to be more specific, last year with a sub $40,000 drive-away price and sold the first 1,000 out in less than a week. And that price was actually about 14 grand below RRP with on-road costs factored in. So basically, instead of marketing the car, Toyota poured all that money into subsidising the cost of it to get the devotees behind the wheel. It's now sold more than 2,000 of them, but for some people, it wasn't quite going to cut the mustard. And this is despite having a bespoke body shell, including a carbon fibre floor and aluminium panels, variable all-wheel drive, the world's most powerful three-cylinder engine. It's a proper WRC homologation special. But still, for some people, that wasn't going to be enough, which is where the GR Yaris Rally comes in. Now, this car costs $5,000 more than the RRP of the regular GR Yaris, which makes it a heck of a lot more expensive than the first 1,000, but that ship has long since sailed. What does it add? Well, it's got Torsen limited slip diffs front and rear to minimise wheel spin by allocating torque to the tyre with the most traction on the road. It's got better brake ducting. It's got unique plaques inside. It's got a much better wheel and tyre package. It's got much more premium rubber as well as forged alloy wheels made by BBS. So it's a pretty good dynamic package. It definitely builds on the regular GR Yaris. It's also got some circuit-tuned suspension, basically stiffer, bigger anti-roll bars at the front, stiffer coils and things of that nature. So it's definitely designed to be a bit stiffer, designed to be a little bit more agile, to put its torque down a little bit more effectively. If you're doing track work in your GR Yaris, it's absolutely the car to have. I think it's going to be a little bit stiff and perhaps a little bit uncompromising for your typical road user. But then again, there is that argument. I know this was Al Borz's argument when he bought one, that if you're going to buy one of the world's most preeminent hot hatches, you kind of have to have the top of the tree one, don't you? You got to have the one with the double diffs and the, you know, the the Michelin rubber and the forged alloy wheels, it would be kind of a shame not to have all that stuff, and you'd probably regret not forking out the extra $5,000 for it. So needless to say, after spending some time driving that on a motor car and on a little tight and technical circuit up in the ACT, I definitely felt fairly inspired to get one. I was really hoping we'd have ATCO covering it, because, you know, a car like that, it's really, so, you know, a WRC legend like ATCO, our performance editor Chris Atkinson, that's going to get the most out of that car. You know, a numpty like me ain't going to sort of scratch the surface of it, but I can definitely say it's a step up on the regular car, and no doubt going to be on the receiving end of a ton of interest.
Did it sound any different?
No, so the powertrain's the same. So it's that mad 200 kilowatt, 370 newton meter, 1.6 litre, three-cylinder engine, which is just amazing, the fact that they can get that much out of a three-banger, six-speed manual with rev matching. The rev matching system didn't work all the time, and I quite often found myself doing the rev matching in the analog fashion. But it's just that sort of angry wasp-like soundtrack just remains exactly as we know it.
How did it handle those corners at the Motocana?
Well, it loves Motocanas. It eats them up, you know, doing some handbrakies and getting on it and you know, navigating a tight and twisty witch's hatted circuit is really that car's happy place. And you really do notice those torsion diffs front and rear. It's really, I guess, getting the power down more effectively, really mitigating wheel spin. If you do get on the throttle a bit too early on exit, like I tend to because I'm not a professional driver, it really does become more forgiving. It certainly allows the average person to squeeze more out of it. And the closer you get to the limit, the better it gets. So if you're a person who's actually going to put this car through its paces properly, and that means driving it on track, it's absolutely the one to have.
Mirko, did you get to drive the two cars back to back? Could you? I know you sort of touched on some of the things that it's better at, but was it more? Were the differences more amplified once you drove them back to back?
On a circuit, absolutely. I mean, one thing I'm dying to do, and I'll find a way to do this, is to get the old and the new. So, yeah, to answer your question, to go back, I did drive both back-to-back on a circuit, and even I spotted the difference. And I can only imagine that somebody like ATCO would spot, you know, more differences than I did. What I would love to do is drive them both back-to-back on a public road. Now, my sense is that the rally is a bit stiffer, a bit firmer. There's definitely less exaggerated body movements. And I suspect driving over your typical cobblestones or patchy roads, particularly the ones that they have in Sydney, it might be a little harder to live with. So my general sort of advice would be, if this is a road car or even a daily, it's probably not the version to get. But I'm dying to put them back to back on a public road at some point in the near future, just to be sure of that.
You can check out that review now live at carexpert.com.au. You're a wealth of information, Mirko. Thank you very much.
Always a pleasure, guys. Thanks heaps.
You get Tony Crawford onto the subject of Porsche, and he will happily talk about it till the cows come home. Hello, Crawford.
Hi, guys. I'm Andy. How are you? J-Wo, Will.
Hi.
Very good. Now, with the Taycan, you got to drive this on track.
Yeah.
And as you said last week, you achieved a pretty incredible 0 to 100K time.
Yeah.
But can you tell us a little bit more about what it was like for the rest of the track experience in it?
Okay. You can read the review on carexpert.com.au. It is up and there is a video. So you get the sense. The video is I'm having a blast. I'm laughing the whole way through. If you look at the video, I'm literally can't keep a straight face. I just can't believe it. You know, a big electric GT car can handle and go do what it does on track. I mean, the car weighs almost 2,300 kilos. I mean, that is a serious piece of machinery there in weight, mm-hmm. and how it goes around corners like a Porsche. Well, let me go back a step. When you get into that car and sit in front of it, besides the all-digital dash, it is like sitting exactly behind my Carrera S. It just feels like a 911. And they do that with a Macan. They do that with a Cayenne. They seem to be very, very good at perfect replication, no matter what genre of car or what segment of car it is. And not only that, I got to say, I don't know whether I'm for a total digital blackout of screens, or a total analog blackout, I should say, replaced by digital. I like a button or two. I love the way my 911 has the five binnacles, actual binnacles there. It's why people used to buy a 911 for that look, those five instruments in front of you. And to not have those, to have them in virtual land.
Do they still look the same though, Crawf, with the orange needle and the white numbers?
Not really, no. There's kind of three of them there. There's not five actual. So from my memory, I have to have a quick look at the thing. But no, it doesn't look like my 911. It doesn't look like a 911 at all. So getting out of the 911 turbo into the Taycan, but it's the future, right? I mean, we can't be grabbing at, you know, old school binnacles, can we? Mm-hmm. I mean, we've got to move forward, right? And like I said in my review, if anyone wanted to blueprint the future of high performance motoring, Porsche have done it already. So copy away, Tesla. You know what I mean? how it drives well, I mean, you can feel the weight. Don't get me wrong. It's 2,300 kilos versus the turbo 911 turbo that we drove, which is 1640. So it is a massive difference, right? It's almost 1,000 kilos you're carrying around. It goes, look, it doesn't drive like a 911 per se. It drives like a Porsche, yes. But
in what way?
Well, the turn-in is amazing. Like you turn in, it was just like being in a 911, the turn-in itself and the steering feel. It was amazing. The balance of the car, even though it is that weight, I felt like I wanted to drift that car. It must be the world's best electric drift car because I'm telling you, I did ask permission off Giordo to actually, do you mind if I get it sideways a bit? Because it just feels like it wants to go sideways, but it needs a bit of encouragement because it's so grippy normally.
What tires are on it?
I'm just trying to remember whether it was, I might be confused here, but the 911 was running two different tyres, the Goodyear and the Goodyear and the Pirelli. I believe it was running Pirellis. And, look, there was tyre squeal, but, you know, there was tyre squeal on Pirellis on the 911 turbo too. So, look, once you get a road car on track and push it to its limits, you're going to get tyre squeal unless you're running slicks. So, bad thing on that at all, and it didn't affect the grip levels. The acceleration is just mind-blowing, right? So you get that 2.4-second 0-100 acceleration when you come out of a corner, and it is just amazing. And I was just working out. It felt like we were in warp speed down the main straight all the way down, of course. But, you know, I've just looked up the fact that the Taycan's top speed is 260. So we obviously didn't exceed 260 unless Porsche are underquoting that as well. Which I wouldn't put
it. What did you get it up to?
Well, I didn't look at the. I was so I was so in raptures of laughter going down the straight at warp speed that I forgot to look at the speedo. But just the late braking and everything. The braking was absolutely superb. It's just amazing. Like you could brake later than you could in a 911 turbo, which, you know, for that size and heft of a vehicle is extraordinary in itself. And, you know, it just kept going around and around. We only had sort of one or two cars there, a Turbo and a Turbo S. I was driving the Turbo S. And, you know, it just got repeatedly abused, track after time after again, lap after lap, and it just keeps doing the same thing. The only thing that's going to wear away a little bit is the tyres, obviously, but.
Don't use that excuse if you get pulled over by the police, Crawf. I was in raptures of laughter driving.
Yeah,
I wasn't really looking at the speedo.
I absolutely wasn't. Thank God it was a track test only. But I tell you what, I'd love to. It's got adaptive suspension, air suspension. I'd love to drive this thing on the road. I know Moco did. I'd love to get around our local and Melbourne roads too and just see how it, you know, see how it cushions the bumps and does it absorb the bumps and is it the best daily, you know? I did remember putting that down on the end of my review. It could be the best daily ever. So, look, I think the range is anywhere from 388 to 412. 388 to 412 for the Turbo S. I think it's about 638 for the 4S being the base.
Yeah, with the longer range battery, it's quite long in that one. Yeah, it's less powerful. Yeah.
So,
what was the EV range like as you were taking it around the track? Was it going down fairly quickly?
That car that we repeatedly abused all four journos over the entire morning, it still had 53%. By the end, they said a funny thing. They said, we've got to fill the 911 turbo up before we have to charge the Taycan after the track sessions.
Oh,
yeah,
really?
Pretty amazing. Yeah, Giordo was very, very keen to get that little anecdotal fact out to us. And that was extraordinary, right? Because the 911 turbo would be filled with 60, 70 litres of fuel. And, you know, to think the Taycan can outlast it on track is amazing.
And it's a heavier car. Yeah.
Amazing. You think about how much you're braking. You're probably charging it heaps while you're coming down the straight and you slam on the brakes into a corner.
That's a good point.
A 911 can't fuel itself as you go.
Absolutely. And then just on that, there's a recharge button on the steering wheel, I recall. And if you're on the road, normal driving, I believe up to 90% of your braking can be done by regen. Which, you know, like the, if any of you guys have ever driven the i3 and put it on to the most aggressive regen, you don't actually use the brake pedal. It's fantastic. And you just get away from the lights quickly. That's the thing I'm going to have fun about, driving the Taycan on the road. You will be able to pull up in that left lane every single time and no worries. Bang and you're gone, you know. Let them stay in the right lane. I'm here beside you, but, you know, we'll get in front.
Krupp, I love asking you this question. Can you sum up the Taycan in one word?
Wow.
I think wow is one word, Mandy. You got your answer.
Yeah.
Call 000 is about to start lighting up.
I guess mind-blowing.
That's two words.
It's
hyphenated, James. It counts.
Yeah, it's hyphenated.
That's enough.
Yeah.
It's a compound.
Yeah. Thank you for a lesson in journalism. I need that. No, I do. I'm serious. I need that. I need reminders.
You're very well.
Yeah, thank you.
I think it's a perfect way to wrap up that. Please go and have a look at the video at carexpert.com.au and watch Krupp in fits of laughter. Anthony Crawford, thank you.
Goodbye.
That's a wrap for this week's podcast. Have we got any events happening next week, Joe?
Yes, so I'm actually going to the media launch of the Nissan Leaf E Plus, which is their new longer range electric vehicle with a larger battery, still with that cute, funky Nissan Leaf body. And then we've also got the Skoda Octavia RS launch coming up, which is a very exciting car for a lot of enthusiasts because I know that's kind of like a cult favorite locally. So we'll be driving the wagon very, very soon. In terms of cars that we've got coming through in Melbourne, we've got quite an interesting mix. So we've got the BMW X2 M35i X-Drive, we've got the Mitsubishi Triton GLS, the MG ZST, and the Peugeot 2008 Allure. I'm actually really excited to see that because I've never seen one in person yet, the new one.
No, neither.
Yeah, so it'll be a cool little thing to have. In Sydney, we've got the Kia Seltos GT line and the Nissan Juke Ti Orange, which is that new option pack for the top spec model that adds splashes of orange, as you might have guessed from the name. And in Brisbane, we've got the Peugeot 3008 GT as well as the BMW M440 X-Drive Coupe. So, Will, when you get back home later next week, you'll have a few toys to play with.
Yes, exactly. I'm very excited to get behind the wheel of the 308. I've been sitting in it every time I've been in the experience center, so now I get a chance to drive it.
Yeah, the interior is amazing in them, aren't they?
Yeah.
It's such an underappreciated car. Scott and I took that back to the hotel one night, and Sydney's roads are a bit different to Melbourne because they're all like
separate rooms, right?
Obviously. Yeah, actually, we didn't even make it to the room. Anyway. I digress. So we drive it back. It's only a 5-minute drive to where we were staying, but some of Sydney's roads are a little bit let's just say rough. They have this funny thing where it's like concrete patchwork across the highways, which can be very bumpy, a bit loud. And so it's actually a really good test of vehicle refinement and ride, actually, now that I think about it. And the Peugeot was wonderful. We drove a couple of cars on that road, and the Peugeot was very comfortable, very quiet. And I think we realized how much we love that car again, because you don't see a whole lot of them around, and they don't sell anywhere near as many as, say, a Mazda CX-5 or a Toyota RAV4. But the level of refinement and comfort in that car is quite good, considering it's a not too expensive, especially at the base level. Great little car.
That's funny. That's another observation you made about Sydney roads, because you were talking about something earlier today that you noticed in Sydney that you found very unusual.
What was it? I can't remember. Oh,
with the lanes not having the dynamic signs.
Oh, yeah. So there's that spit bridge into the northern beaches. Have you been over that? So there's a bridge that goes from the main part of Sydney into the northern beaches. It's this one bridge, and it's got like, I think, three lanes on each side. Or no, it's four lanes across. And so you know how in most places there's like variable lanes where the overhead gantries will flash an X when you're not meant to go down there, and you've got greens and whatever. There's like, they've got these almost like the cone hat orange like cylinders that they put in the ground to mark the lanes. And every day there's a guy in the truck that changes the lanes at certain times. And it's incredibly bizarre. Like I thought, like, it's one of the richest places in New South Wales, and that's how they do their lane changes. And it holds up traffic so much. Like, it's such an inefficient way of doing things. And I'm not trying to trash talk Sydney. I think Sydney is one of the most beautiful places in the world. And that bridge actually goes over like a mini harbour and marina that's actually quite picturesque, and you see the houses on the hills. It's gorgeous.
Yeah.
But that bridge in peak hour is just a calamity. It's very, very weird. And just to see the guy getting out, like hanging on the side of a truck, you know, like the guys hang on the side of the garbage trucks picking bins up and putting, it was like that, but he's pulling up the orange cylinders out of the holes in the ground and then putting them somewhere else to mark the lanes. And it's, you see the traffic siphoning down from three lanes to one to get over this bridge.
Oh,
and it would put up your travel time by about 20 minutes once, you know, you've got lights on each side and all that kind of thing. It's very weird.
Yeah.
But
apparently those things, you don't want to run over them. A friend of a friend of mine, late one night, oh, let's drive over these things and see what happens. No.
Oh, yeah, so don't drive over them. Friend, Mandy, sure. It was you. You can admit it. You ran them down. We've all wanted to do it. We've all wanted to run those flappy ones down or run into these water barrels just like it's GTA. Yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, Scott and I had this conversation driving towards Sydney at one point, and we noticed that while the orange bits that sit above the ground look like they're squishy like a witch's hat, the bits that hold them in are slightly raised and they're made out of metal. So I reckon you'd probably wreck one of your suspension coils if you went over one of them at a certain level of speed. So we were like, yeah, that's probably not a good idea, even if it was just a joke.
Nope. All right. It's been fun this week. James Wong and William Stopford, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks,
Mandy.
Thanks, Mandy, and drive safely.